This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not like the housing market needed more bad news. You might have thought after subprimes and months of bad sales figures, the spring would have brought some relief. But then you remember that capitalism just doesn't work like that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Marketplace is also supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Monday today, March 26th. So glad to have you with us. It stands to reason that if you're selling less of whatever product it is that you sell, your inventory is going to rise. That's exactly the situation the new home market finds itself in today. Unexpectedly, too. If sales continue at last month's pace, it'd take more than 8 months to get through all the freshly built houses that are on the market. Wall Street's best and brightest missed big on their estimates of the February housing market. And Janet Babin at North Carolina Public Radio reports inventory's the least of the worries.
The Commerce Department reported that new home sales fell 3.9% from January to February, the lowest rate since 2000. Analysts were expecting the number to rise after housing starts and existing home sales were up for the month. Economist David Weiss at Standard & Poor's says the number could be a blip, and he blames it on the weather, the third coldest February in over a century.
It's winter. And in winter, the housing statistics do weird things. I want to wait for the spring numbers before I get excited about what's going on here.
There was hope that the housing market had found bottom and would begin to crawl back up. But this latest figure suggests that the market could still be correcting itself. Economist Richard DeKayser at National City Corporation says new home sales alone don't give the full picture. He adds them together with existing home sales to get total home sales.
And if you look at total home sales as so measured, the low point is actually back as far as last September of 2006. Since that time, we've seen stability. One could even argue maybe a little bit of an uptrend.
But DeKayser warns that construction activity remains weak, and that could dampen the overall economy. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Citigroup made $5.1 billion last quarter. A tidy sum, but well short of the $6.9 billion it made same time a year ago. So in a couple of weeks, the country's biggest financial services company will present a major restructuring plan. The idea, of course, is to cut costs and increase those profits. But details, of course, have already leaked. Today, the Wall Street Journal reported it could involve as many as 15,000 job cuts. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more from New York.
Citigroup will present its official plan sometime next month, but it will reportedly cut or move as many as 15,000 jobs in expensive cities like New York, London, and Hong Kong. Speculation is the plan could save the company as much as $1 billion. It's just as well. It's been criticized recently for having operating costs that are bigger than revenue growth. Richard Beauvais is a strategist at Punk Siegel.
This is a company where for a decade they have underinvested in their core businesses. And because they've underinvested in their core businesses, their revenues are not growing and they're losing market share.
He says Citigroup spends too much on acquiring other companies and not enough on building the businesses it has. But analyst Jeff Hart at Sandler O'Neill says Citigroup has been doing just fine.
They've been making a lot of investments that needed to be made. If anything, they were been kind of making up for what appears in hindsight to have been years of underinvestment.
Meanwhile, the company says it expects much of its future investment to be overseas. That's what the company's CEO told employees in India today. Citigroup is one of the largest foreign banks there, and Citigroup will likely continue to increase both its retail presence and outsourcing operations. Doing more work in India will save money with labor costs. But Richard Beauvais says there's another benefit to a big presence in what will be the world's largest country.
If you can grow with the Indian population and with the wealth of the Indian population, you have enormous opportunity.
Citigroup is also expected to take jobs to cheaper cities in the U.S., such as Buffalo and Cincinnati. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
If you've got a weak heart, New Orleans is the place to be this week. Not for any of that Big Easy stuff, but because there's a cardiologist's convention in town. As usual, they're issuing a raft of reports about how to treat the country's biggest killer. One of those studies got so much buzz today, it started to move the markets, so it was released early. There is some evidence that heart stents, those tiny metal scaffolds that doctors put into arteries to hold them open, don't work as well as drugs do. Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH.
This new trial is the first to study whether stents reduce heart attacks and death. 2,300 patients with stable heart disease, that's chest pain but no imminent risk of a heart attack, were split in two. One group got aggressive drug treatment, the other drug treatment plus stents. Kuhn Teo was one of the investigators. He spoke on his cell phone from the conference.
There was no difference in terms of heart attacks and deaths in the two groups.
Teo teaches medicine at McMaster University. He says the study suggests lifestyle changes and drug therapy should be the first plan for stable heart patients. But stents can also cause blood clots, and Wall Street analysts reckon now cardiologists will become increasingly cautious.
This study will add to the concern about using stents in general.
Piper Jaffray's Tom Gunderson says media attention helped fuel today's drop in the stock price of some makers of stents, like Boston Scientific and Medtronic. But Gunderson says this study's flawed. It looks at heart attacks and death, and that's not what stents are for.
Was there a reduction in heart pain? Was there an increase in the quality of life? And that's what stents are made to do, is reduce the chest pain and give you the opportunity to play a full 18 without having to quit early.
Stent makers also criticized the trial. It used older devices, not the new ones coated with drugs to keep arteries open better. And they warn if cardiologists get skittish about using stents, more people may end up with acute heart disease. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Those housing numbers put a dent in Wall Street early, but investors still managed to eke out some gains today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Bush had a photo op out on the South Lawn of the White House today. I'm not sure if he actually kicked any tires, but he did get a personal tour of Detroit's latest flex fuel offerings. Those are cars that can run on either traditional gas or on ethanol. Alternative fuels have been a favorite of the president's, at least since his State of the Union speech. Here he is from this morning.
If you want to reduce gasoline usage, like I believe we need to do so for national security reasons as well as for environmental concerns, the consumer has got to be in a position to make a rational choice.
The walkabout followed half an hour in the Oval Office with the CEOs of Ford, GM, and Chrysler. They were there to talk about reducing U.S. gasoline consumption. The automakers say more use of alternative fuels is the key. Left unsaid has been anything about boosting fuel economy standards. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton has that story.
Nearly 2 weeks after the Big Three put in some congressional time to lobby against higher fuel economy or CAFE standards, U.S. auto executives are back in Washington. President Bush called the meeting to talk about his proposal to reduce U.S. gas consumption 20% over the next decade. GM Chief Executive Rick Wagner says flex fuel vehicles, which can run off of a blend of corn-based ethanol called E85, will go a long way toward achieving Bush's goal.
This makes a big difference, and there's nothing that can be done which can reduce the curve of growth in imported oil and actually turn it down like using E85, taking advantage of what's there today.
Executives from the Big Three say they could make half of their new vehicles biofuel-ready by 2012. But David Friedman with the Union of Concerned Scientists says unless Congress boosts CAFE standards, more flex-fuel vehicles will do little to cut gasoline usage.
If at the end of the day all we do is switch from guzzling gasoline to guzzling ethanol, we certainly aren't going to make the progress that we need.
Friedman says most of the 6 million flex-fuel vehicles already on the road are huge trucks and SUVs, and many of them rarely fill up with E85 since so few gas stations carry the stuff. The automakers say government incentives are needed to boost infrastructure. But economist Stephen Zackley with the Center for Automotive Research says there are better ways to spend the cash.
And one has to wonder if we invested that money in, say, a more efficient internal combustion engine or hybrid electric vehicles, wouldn't that be a better and greater benefit for the cost?
That, of course, depends on who's footing the bill. Zackley says making cars flex fuel compatible only costs automakers about $100 a pop. Making them more fuel efficient can run into the thousands. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
One thing you didn't hear President Bush or the car company CEOs pointing out this morning is that right about the time they were talking, oil was hitting $63 a barrel. Or that gas prices are up sharply as well, more than a nickel in the past 2 weeks. $2.61 is the average for a gallon of self-serve regular now. Part of that's geopolitical. Tensions in the Middle East and supply problems in Nigeria rarely make prices go down. But commentator and consumer advocate Jamie Court suggests there's some sleight of hand behind those rising gas prices, too.
It's simple physics. When it gets hot, gasoline expands, so you get less energy per gallon. Unfortunately, our gas pumps don't account for that. So in warm weather, drivers get less energy out of their gasoline and have to fill up more often. On average, that costs Americans about $1.7 billion every year in overcharges, according to the Kansas City Star. It works like this. When gas station owners buy their gas from oil companies, they get the gallon they pay for. They do that by measuring the temperature of the gas and making sure they're getting the extra volume that matches that higher temperature. But then, when gas stations sell that gas to us consumers, they don't adjust for the actual temperature. In hotter places like California, consumers end up paying about 3 cents more per gallon on average than they're really getting. That adds up. Of course, it works both ways. In colder climates, oil companies would be selling gas that delivers more punch per gallon. They're hip to this. They've installed temperature-adjusted pumps in Canada so that motorists pay them fully for their gas. The only state in the U.S. that forces oil companies to temperature-adjust the gas they sell to consumers is Hawaii. Now, finally, California has approved the use of a temperature-adjusted pump. The snag is the manufacturer suddenly said it won't be selling the technology in the state. Reportedly, oil companies threatened to boycott that company's products. That's absurd. It would be like letting supermarkets rig produce scales and then stopping the sale of accurate scales all across America. What do we do? If Canada can temperature adjust their gas, so can all of America. But it's probably going to take the government to force our global warmers to give us an honest measurement as the heat rises.
Jamie Courts, the president of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. You can send us your thoughts through our website. It's marketplace.org. Ian Paisley and Jerry Adams sat down at a conference table in Belfast today. Nothing at all remarkable about it, until you remember the troubles, the decades of violence between Northern Ireland's Protestants and Catholics. Paisley's a Protestant. He runs the Democratic Unionist Party, pro-British. Jerry Adams is a Catholic. He's the head of Sinn Féin, which is closely tied to the Irish Republican Army and favors union with the Republic of Ireland. The two have agreed on a historic plan to govern together. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports economics played a major role in bringing them together.
Northern Ireland's long peace process has produced many surprises, but few as extraordinary as this. Ian Paisley, having thundered for 40 years against the men of violence, sat down today and talked for the first time with former IRA chief Gerry Adams. And at a joint news conference afterwards, he held out an olive branch.
We must not allow our justified loathing of the horrors and tragedies of the past to become a barrier to creating a better and more stable future for our children.
Paisley has agreed to share power with Sinn Féin in a local government for Northern Ireland. It's scheduled to take office on March the 8th. Gerry Adams hailed it an historic breakthrough.
I believe the agreement reached between Sinn Féin and the DUP marks the beginning of a new era of politics on this island.
Oddly enough, one of the key factors in this momentous event was a utility bill. London had been about to send the people of Northern Ireland water bills for the first time. Locally elected representatives could stop that happening. The water bills loomed large in the province's recent local elections, says Northern Ireland Secretary Peter Hain.
Now, these proved hugely unpopular and became the dominant issue of the election campaign, and the people said to their parties, we don't like these water charges, get into power and do something about it.
In fact, says Bob Barber of the Centre for Competitiveness, the dominant feature of the campaign was not the ancient rivalry between the pro and the anti-British, it was economics.
That's what drove the election. It was get into government, get the economy going, get this place sorted out, let's move on.
Although Northern Ireland's standard of living has been hugely improved by the peace process, it still lags the rest of Britain, and the province falls embarrassingly short of the stellar performance of the Irish Republic south of the border, says economist Mike Smith.
23 of the Fortune 100 companies have their European bases in the Republic of Ireland. There's not one of them in Northern Ireland.
Attracting foreign investment will be a priority for Paisley and Adams. Who knows whether this unlikely economics team will prove a winning partnership. For now, says commentator Malachy Doherty, we can only stand back and marvel at a political miracle.
Two men who have been looking at each other eyeball to eyeball across a wasteland of their own making for over 40 years are agreeing to share power with each other.
In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, car or sex object?
This erotic piece of sculpture is the Ferrari 599 GTB Fiorano. It is the latest and greatest license killer from Maranello in Italy, and it's some kind of car.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slumped 11 points today, a tenth of 1% to close at 12,469. The NASDAQ inched up 6 points, about a quarter percent, finished at 2455. The S&P 500 crept up 1 point, a tenth of 1% to end at 1437. Higher oil prices took their toll, as did those home sales numbers we told you about. Luxury home builder Toll Brothers lost 1.8%. Another top home builder, Pulte Homes, chipped off more than 1%. Alcatel-Lucent shares beamed up more than 3% after the French telecom company clinched a $6 billion contract with Verizon Wireless. And that news about stents affected a couple of companies in the medical sector. Boston Scientific fell 6.5%. Abbott Laboratories, though, cooked up a gain of more than 6%. Overseas markets were mixed. Back home, bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.6%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses competition and consumer choice in sports programming. And a House committee enters uncharted waters, talking about crimes on cruise ships and issues of reporting, investigating, and prosecuting crimes that occur at sea. They say over 10 million Americans will take a cruise from a U.S. port in 2007. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's a business kind of week for the Supreme Court. Justices heard arguments on a case involving consumer prices today, whether or not manufacturers can set minimums that retailers would have to charge. Wall Street's keeping an eye on tomorrow's case. Big investment banks are defendants in a suit over initial public offering prices during the dot-com boom. The accusations are familiar that IPO prices were unjustifiably inflated back in the late 1990s. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the legal infighting has gotten the government involved.
In December 1999, a tiny computer company called VA Linux went public. The pre-IPO hype convinced one Swiss investor to buy some shares as soon as they hit the open market. His attorney, Mel Weiss, says that first day, the price jumped from $30 a share to more than $300.
He was in the United States visiting, and he got on a plane, and he found out when he got to the other side that he spent $3 million for those shares.
And did he end up losing money?
Oh, yes, he lost most of it.
Weiss claims the investment bank that underwrote the IPO artificially pumped up its price. In a class action lawsuit, he and other attorneys accused the major banks of doling out shares in hundreds of hot IPOs, only if their customers agreed to buy more stock later at higher prices, or if those customers essentially kicked back some of their profits. Steve Thiel teaches securities law at Fordham University. He says what's new about the case is that the attorneys argued those practices broke federal and state antitrust laws.
Clearly, either of those things would be a violation of the securities laws themselves. But the plaintiffs want to bring the action under the antitrust laws, partly because in the antitrust laws, the damages are trebled. Instead of getting $1 for each loss you have, you get $3. And so the antitrust laws are much more attractive for a plaintiff.
But they're also controversial. A district court dismissed Weiss's lawsuit. The judge ruled that because investment banks are heavily regulated by securities laws, antitrust laws don't apply. But a federal appeals court disagreed. Now it's up to this country's highest court to decide. Justices have heard an earful from the business and securities lobbies. Robin Conrad is with the National Chamber Litigation Center, the legal arm of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. She says if the Supreme Court allows this case to go forward,
you're going to have duplicative regulatory authorities. You're going to have the potential for inconsistent rulings. And that's what's going to make it very risky for underwriters.
And anything risky is especially alarming to Wall Street these days, what with all the talk of London and Hong Kong siphoning off its IPO business. Regulators have weighed in on the fight as well. The Securities and Exchange Commission says antitrust challenges could interfere with its oversight of the industry. But Fordham Law's Steve Thiel says the government hasn't done enough to pursue the practices in question. A few cases brought by the SEC settled. And when firms settle, they don't have to admit or deny any wrongdoing.
Part of what needs to happen is to examine what really happened, to search the record, look for incriminating emails, or find the absence of them. And the only way to do that is to allow a case like this to proceed. Without cases like this, we don't know.
If the Supreme Court allows this case to go forward, it will return to the district court that originally dismissed it. And Thiel says it could still stall. The federal government has asked the Supreme Court to require the district court to examine the case further before letting it proceed. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We are here outside the Frank Stanton studio in our lovely parking garage with our car guy, Dan Neal from the LA Times. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Kai. Nice to be here.
Nice to be here with you and this car. What have we today?
This erotic piece of sculpture is the Ferrari 599 GTB Fiorano. It is the latest and greatest license killer from Maranello in Italy. And it's some kind of car.
Now, the last couple of times you've been with us, it's been all about alternative fuels and plug-in hybrids and all that sensible stuff that Detroit is trying to do.
We're not going to talk about that today, are we?
No, this car has a rather black heart on that score. it gets about, I don't know, 9, 11 miles per gallon. But the redeeming virtue is that you don't drive it very far.
That's right. But you do it very, very fast.
Yes, that's true.
Detroit, as we both know, has been having a really difficult couple of years. Not so with Ferrari. Their business is really almost too good.
Ferrari has an enviable problem. They've got far too many customers to satisfy. This is especially true because there's so much new wealth in the market. And their business model is all about exclusivity. You know, Ferrari just doesn't sell to anybody off the street. And this has created a vast secondary market for Ferraris.
What would you have to pay to get, say, one of these if you were on a waiting list?
Well, these are too new, really, to be in the country. But I'll give you an example. All right. The Ferrari F430 Spider has a retail of about $204,000, and there's a two-year waiting list if you go through a dealer. However, if you go on eBay, you can get one for a mere, let's see, I have it here, $329,000. That's a $125,000 markup. And so thank you, Lamborghini of Houston.
Can't they just make these cars faster?
No. Ferrari, as I say, their business model is all about exclusivity. There is a theoretical limit to how many cars they can make in Maranello. All Ferraris have to be made on that hallowed ground. And so they can't open another factory. And more than that, they really only want, you know, about 1,500 cars a year imported to the U.S. However, emerging markets, China, Russia, Brazil, now those they can build cars for those markets.
Let's go for a ride.
Okay.
There's a ridiculous amount of information on that dashboard.
Yes, there is.
You can't possibly take it.
There's tire pressure, tire temperature. This thing will tell you if your brakes, the state of your brake wear. Oops, oh. Scrape the bottom. Sorry.
Because we got to make that green light, Dan. That's very important.
All right, good. You'll notice the brakes are sensational.
They are. They absolutely are.
I love that sound. This car is make all your rock and roll fantasies come true. It is a dream weaver.
Walk me through this thing, what you think about when you're driving it.
My first impression when I got the car a few days ago was that I couldn't believe that any car that can do what this car can do on the track is so civil, so supple, and so easy to drive. This is truly, I mean, a lot of car companies say it, but this is truly an everyday supercar.
Two things. One, I wasn't as scared as I sounded. And two, we took some pictures while Dan was here. They're online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. Mutual funds, IRAs, and college savings. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE or TRowePrice.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, Dennis Kozlowski was on 60 Minutes last night. You might have seen it. The former Tyco CEO did his best to put some spin on the reason he's in jail. That is, lavish spending with company money. One day later, same story, different executive. Lawrence Small, the top official at the Smithsonian Institution, has resigned after questions were raised about his spending habits and after Congress threatened to freeze all funding for the Smithsonian. One example, in the past 6 years, Small has charged the government more than $1.1 million for the use of his home for fundraising. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fought its way back to finish down only 11 points, 0.1%. The Nasdaq rose 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 rose 1 point. That is 0.1%. Our producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, where Mickey, Goofy, and Bob Iger are all heading.
What digital technology has done, it's created a huge power shift from the creator and the distributor, the old world, to the consumer, the new world. Disney acknowledges the consumer power in the marketplace today.
It's a conversation from Disney's corner office. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.